So the purpose of today is not solely to talk to you about a single research program that we've been undertaking in collaboration with the Australian Antarctic Division, but also I think to reinforce some of the key messages that previous speakers have been presenting. Without the human interface, there is no research program. There is no mission. And so we need to ensure that individual health, physiological, psychological, and social, are addressed and managed to maximise human performance and outcomes in extreme environments. I think from some of the previous presentations, we've become much more familiar with why Antarctica in particular is considered a space analogue, being one of the most extreme environments on Earth. And we tend to, as psychologists, classify it along four key parameters. The first one being physical. It's so inhospitable. The fact that there is no indigenous population in Antarctica, in terms of human life, is testimony to how extreme it is. It is the coldest, highest, driest, and windiest continent on Earth. Human life cannot be sustained without the aid of really complex technologies. Socially, it's actually really homogenous. So although there is individual level differences between people on research stations and working in the field, the reality is that these are all well-adjusted, highly functioning individuals. There's also the lack of social novelty that you'll normally see in everyday life. So it's not as though you have any control, or at least the same degree of control you're used to, in terms of who you spend time with, how much time you spend with them, or even whose room is next to yours. So those things we tend to take for granted about, I get to finish my work day, go home, and I don't have to think about anyone from work, that goes. Because these individuals live, work, sleep, socialise, all in the same environment. From a technological perspective, I've already mentioned that human life cannot be sustained without those aid of really complex technologies. And the psychological parameters, which have been so strongly reinforced through all of the presentations today, actually have reciprocal relationships with all other dimensions. So if there are physiological challenges, there are also consequential psychological challenges. If you're experiencing some degree of pain, that impacts on your cognitive resources, your affective functioning as well. Socially, you didn't get to choose who you're down there with. You had no control over that whatsoever. And as has guaranteed, you're not going to like everyone there. That, of course, further taxes your psychological aspects. And it's because of both the psychological indices in and of themselves, as well as these reciprocal relationships with the other parameters, that the psychological parameters have a disproportionately larger impact on human adaptation and functioning than all others. Now, a caveat to that, it doesn't mean that we are rife with psychological disorders or mental health issues in places such as Antarctica, space, submarines. What it means is the capacity for these resources to be taxed is much, much higher. And in reality, current estimates suggest that only about 1 to 4% of Antarctic populations will actually have a clinically diagnosable mental health condition. So that's really small numbers when you consider that in the general population, we have upwards of 20-odd percent for certain disorders. So I think that's important to remember, that although there are these psychological challenges, it doesn't mean that we're doomed. Because of the vast volume of analogue studies that have been conducted and continue to be and continue to increase our knowledge base in this domain, we are very aware of the impacts of extreme environments on individual health and well-being, as well as their performance. So we know that there are generally cognitive deficits. We see decrements in memory, concentration, attention, processing speed. There's the impacts on physiological functioning, so there's those immunosuppressant activities, there can be injuries imbued by the environment, and of course, affective functioning. That's at the individual level. Running in parallel to this, We know also the impacts of extreme environments on team level performance. And that, again, has been emphasised by previous speakers. We can't just think at the individual level. We have to think at the team level, at the organisation level, because at each level it introduces additional complexities and additional psychological challenges that have to be managed. We can't overestimate, we can't overemphasise the need for team cohesion. Now, team cohesion does not mean that we're all holding hands and singing Kumbaya all the time. What it means is that there can be a level of respect and team dynamic that facilitates goal attainment. When we have a team that's working well, when they have that shared goal system, when they can work towards an overarching achievement as opposed to simply individual level needs, we have something referred to in the social psychological literature as social facilitation. And that's fundamentally where the mere presence of supportive others can improve both individual performance and, as a result, team outcomes. Now, that's what we aim to do. And that's why there is ongoing debate about whether we should be selecting individuals to work in these extreme environments, be it Antarctica, be it space, or whether we should be selecting at a team level. So should we be focusing on the best fit of team members rather than the best individuals that we then place in a team? Because we are human and because we don't always like each other, at least all the time, there are risks in terms of negative team outcomes, and they can be along a raft of continuums. But one in particular may be social loafing. And that's the idea that there are so many other people here, or there are other people here that have a similar value system. I can take my foot off the pedal. I can put less input in because I'm not getting the feedback. I'm not getting the recognition I personally need. So what we're aiming for is social facilitation to facilitate goal achievement and basically create a reciprocal relationship with cohesion. So we're cohesive, we achieve more. We achieve more, that reinforces our social bonds. So it sounds very straightforward, sounds very intuitive, and, you know, in many ways, achievable. The missing link in a majority of research that examines adaptation and performance in extreme environments is about the family and friends who are not physically there. Because I, even though they are physically absent, in a majority of cases they are psychologically present. So the individuals working in those extreme environments are thinking about their family, are thinking about their friends, are thinking about the elderly relative who may or may not still be there when they get back, are thinking about missed birthdays, anniversaries. And whilst we wouldn't expect this to be a constant stream that's at the forefront of their mind, it does tend to intrude. It tends to intrude most when there is downtime. So that idea of having recreational activities available for distraction is a very positive one. But also, if there has been some degree of contact with home that suggests all is not well, then the intrusions become more readily accessible. And furthermore, if there is negative team dynamic on station, on shuttle, wherever, it's like a form of escapism. So fundamentally, we've forgotten about this pre-made social support network that we are removing people from, only to enter them into a new team dynamic. There are two main exceptions to this, if you like, deficit. One being Taylor and McCormick in the late 80s, who examined a group of 12 Antarctic expeditioners and their wives to examine how mood fluctuations impacted one another. And myself and colleagues, including Dr. Jeff Ayton, who from a period of 2005 to 2010, followed expeditioners and their partners to determine the level of reciprocal relationships between the experience of an expeditioner and their partner back home. So I'll briefly talk to you a little bit about what we found and then through the subsequent model we developed as a result of this. Something we perhaps did not expect to find is that out of the whole deployment experience, be it from pre-departure, during time on the ice, to when you first get home, which we refer to as the reunion period, so about those first 2 months, until reintegration, which is about 12 months after you get home. The hardest time in terms of psychological experience is not while you're away. And it's actually not while you get back. It's before you go. And the reason for that seems to be, based on the data we've gathered, are a number of factors, including competing demands. So you're simultaneously training, preparing, involving yourself in this new team to facilitate enhanced performance when you go away. At the same time, you're trying to make sure you see all the important people in your life. You get all your affairs in order because you're not sure always what might happen in your absence. The other thing that tends to happen from a relationship perspective, it's beyond the scope of this talk to really delve too much into single expeditionary experiences, which we also investigated. But in terms of the relationship experience, most healthy relationships travel along to a degree in parallel. There's lots of shared experiences, shared expectations and values. During the intensive nature of pre-departure, due to those increasing work demands and the increasing excitement on behalf of the individual who's about to deploy, those paths tend to start to diverge. And so that degree of shared experience, shared value, starts to decline. And as a result, conflict can increase. So I've already said that while they're away, there are those occasional intrusions about what's going on at home. Now imagine if before you left, there was conflict. That's going to increase the risk of those intrusions. The other thing we found is that from a mental health perspective, expeditioners actually fare much better than their partners before they go and while they're away. When expeditioners get home, there's a bit of a letdown. You know, the excitement, that high level of achievement is gone. And so we see this interesting relationship where suddenly the partner well-being skyrockets. The expeditioner's home. And no, I don't want to hear about it anymore. You've had your say. You're not talking about it at the next dinner party. No, you're not going back. Whereas the expeditioner, actually, their mood drops. Because their experiences, that value system, that team cohesion is suddenly removed. And that's why we strongly encourage them to maintain those social networks, those team relationships after they return, because they're actually really important in terms of adjusting again. We also know that if the pre-departure and reunion experience is handled well, then the likelihood of the expeditioner returning for subsequent employment is much, much higher. Now, that's important for a number of reasons. In terms of psychological fulfilment for the expeditioner, but let's be really pragmatic. If you've got someone who's been down before, if you've got someone who has that experience, they are an amazing resource to have on station. They not only have that pre-existing experience, but they become a mentor. And they can provide that mentorship to newer expeditioners, both about the pragmatics of this is how station life works, to also include this is how, you know, you can keep your relationship healthy. So that's a lot of data and a lot of years of research really condensed. But visually, this is what we found. So when it comes to adaptation, now this adaptation, interestingly, works in terms of adapting whilst away, so on the ice, in the space analogue, as well as return upon home. There are individual level factors that do influence this process. And it's really interesting because it seems to be quite pervasive in submariners, in expeditioners, across the board. We want you to be sociable, but not too sociable. We want you to be able to cope with your own company, but be able to get along with a small, confined group. So individually, we don't want high levels of neuroticism. We want sociability. We want, you know, adaptive capacity. From a relationship perspective, and this when I'm talking about relationships, friends, family, if things are not good before you go, they are going to be worse, both while you're away and when you get back. If things are good, then you're much more likely to have those more positive adaptation processes because of the social support it provides. Interestingly also, though, there needs to be a strong interrelationship or a strong communication process between family and friends and the organisation, because that engenders more information sharing and communication occurring not just with the expeditioner, but with the partners. Because often, if you can keep those partners feeling more psychologically secure, then they're going to vent less to the expeditioner, who then worries less about things they can't control. And I must admit, it was really interesting hearing a moment ago about the military approach to screening some of those messages, because definitely in the research cohort we were working with, we had partners and expeditioners engaging in self-screening. I'm not going to share that because I know all it's going to do is upset that person and they can't do anything to fix it. So it's really interesting to see one more formally endorsed and one more at a grassroots level being implemented. Now, if you're communicating, if you're sharing information, that sense of social support is enhanced, and ultimately that leads to improved trust. And trust is fundamental here in terms of a successful program, a successful individual, successful relationships. And through that trust, people feel empowered, they feel stable, secure and able, and therefore adapt well. So what do we do with that data now that we know that there is this interrelationship between the organisation, family and friends, and the individual, and that it spans from pre-deployment, during the time away, and well after you return? Well, fundamentally, we have this same problem that we talked about earlier with astronauts, expeditioners, and I have no doubt many other occupations. Psychological interventions are historically underutilised, because if you're not psychologically well, you don't get to go again. You get blacklisted. And so you're not going to disclose such challenges. So there's that perceived risk to employment, but also to identity. Individuals who work in these environments are, you know, they are the best of the best. They are highly functioning, highly intelligent individuals, and part of their self-identity is based on this sense of, I am the cream of the crop. And generally, there's this reluctance to engage in this way. So what we suggest is, instead of just having it as a, in crisis, please call, we embed psychological interventions into organisational training programs before they go, as well as just-in-time approaches during the mission. So in other words, you can access them confidentially with support on an as-needed basis, because psychological research has shown if you target it at the right time, it's much more acceptable, and of course post-return. The other part to this is we need to ensure dissemination of our knowledge, not just amongst researchers, but also to family and friends of expeditioners and indeed astronauts. Because often if they have this knowledge and therefore structure to hang their experiences on, they are much less distressed. So fundamentally, what we want to do is remember that there are the individual, organisational and relationship factors that span the entire deployment experience, and that our research paradigms need to ensure that all of these aspects are simultaneously assessed to understand the mechanisms underpinning them, and we need to develop a comprehensive and robust human research program to complement our space endeavours. I think we're doing a good job, but I think it's situations like this that could further Australia's research paradigm in this regard.